Okay, good evening. For those who don't know me, my name is Yair Lichtman. I'm really honored to be filling in for Rabbi Myers for this shiur this week. And I was really excited for the format in particular because it gave me an opportunity to, in some ways, reminisce and relive certain formative experiences in my own religious life. And I'm happy to be able to share some of those key ideas with you. So for tonight, what we're going to be tackling is one sort of major contemporary religious figure, incredibly influential figure, both in Israel and to a lesser extent in the American scene, and some of his major, I guess, ethical religious thinking, specifically around the question of natural morality and the role of our own sort of innate morality as it relates to ideas in Torah. And we'll tackle that from a couple of different perspectives. So the plan for the shiur, let's start the slides. The plan for the shiur tonight is to study the biography of Rabbi Yehuda Amital, touching on some major ideas which animated his thoughts. We'll make reference to a number of those kind of parenthetically as we go, and then explore his approach in particular to the role of natural morality and your own moral intuitions and how they relate to other aspects of our religious lives. Just going back to the cover slide for a moment. So this is Rav Amital on the left of this image. To his right is Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who I think has been covered in this series of classes before. And we'll be making a brief reference to him as we continue to go on. So just starting with Rav Amital's biography. So Rav Yehuda Amital was born Yehuda Klein. He was also not born a Rav in Transylvania in Europe. He studied in his hometown under Rav Chaim Yehuda Levi, grandson of Rav Shmuel Glasner. We're going to come back to him in a little bit because he has a certain influence on some of Rav Amital's major ethical religious thinking. And that's actually more or less the extent of his education. He studied in cheder and in yeshivas. He actually had very little proper secular education. He didn't go to university, even high school. So his sort of secular education was quite limited, and his religious education, as we'll see, was very, very significant. Oh, sorry, just one moment. I'll pause the recording as well. About that. Okay, sorry about that brief pause. So anyway, Amital was born in 1924. By 1944, he's still living in Europe, where he is sent to a labor camp. In the Holocaust, he was in that camp for 8 months before the Soviets liberated the camp, and he made Aliyah and moved to Israel. The rest of his family was not sent to a labor camp; they were sent to Auschwitz, and did not survive that. Rav Amital, after making Aliyah, continued his yeshiva studies in Hebron and Kletsk and different yeshivot in Israel. He received a smicha from Rav Itzhak Zalman Meltzer, a major rabbinic figure of the period. There are a number of important works that he's contributed to the Torah corpus. He did serve in Tzahal. He was fought in the War of Independence in 1948. Later on, had certain religious roles, including prominently being a teacher in Yeshivat Hadarom, where, and this is one major idea we'll touch on already, he developed the idea of Yeshivot Hesder. Yeshivot Hesder basically are yeshivot where students study Torah, generally post high school, for a number of years, and combined with that, serve in Tzahal and in the Israeli army as well. With the idea that instead of having the world of the yeshiva and the world of service of the Jewish people kind of cloistered off in different worlds, having yeshivot hesder is a way to bridge those different responsibilities, right? To A, make sure that the country is being served and protected by more able-bodied people, and also to have a bridge between the world of Torah and the world of service of the Jewish people and service of the nation of Israel. And that's a particularly important idea that he was involved in developing, though his yeshiva were not the first to implement this kind of program. After the Six-Day War, Rav Amital did found his own yeshiva, or rather he was invited to be the Rosh Yeshiva of a newly founded yeshiva. So obviously he had a lot of role in determining the nature of that yeshiva. This is Yeshivat Har Etzion, where I was lucky to be a student. This was about 10 years ago for me. Rav Amital was one of the founding Rosh Yeshiva. You really would say he's the founding Rosh Yeshiva in just after 67, after the Six-Day War. The yeshiva was founded in Kfar Etzion in the Gush. He invited Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who we saw in that first picture, on the cover slide to serve as the co-Rosh Yeshiva in 1971, which is not such a common thing to do, to invite a co-founding yeshiva, Rosh Yeshiva to join you in founding your own yeshiva. Definitely involves ceding some kinds of control or vision over what the yeshiva is going to look like. And he supported the founding of Mechlelat Herzog, which is an academic college in Israel. It is actually directly adjacent to the yeshiva. So when you're in Yeshivat Har Etzion, if you walk down the right path of hallways, you'll end up in this more college-like environment, with a particular reference on certain kinds of advanced study of Tanakh. Happens to be his own interesting conversation we'll save for another time. Avramitel was more politically involved than your average, Rosh Yeshiva you might imagine in America or in Europe. In Israel, Rosh Yeshiva are more politically involved than elsewhere, because the boundaries between Jewish society and politics and government are obviously much more fluid. In principle, another notable ideological position of his, he was in the minority of religious figures who supported, at least in principle, the idea of trading land for peace. So in the context of peace negotiations in Israel, as opposed to many in the religious Zionist circles who were completely opposed to the idea of ceding back a land for the potential of peace, Avramitel in principle supported it. Meaning in terms of the hierarchy of values, he thought the value of protecting and saving Jewish lives was higher on the list of values than the value of protecting the integrity of the land. Now that's to bracket the political question of whether giving land actually produces peace or whether it has in the past, but at least in principle, that is a notable position. He did serve in the government. He was not a member of Knesset, but he was a minister under Shimon Peres in the Knesset. Again, not as a member properly, but as a government servant. And in his political life, he was involved in founding the moderate religious Zionist political party, Meimad, which has had not a tremendous political impact, but certainly as a voice for a certain kind of moderate religious Zionism was a very significant voice politically at the time. So that is all by way of broadly speaking background biographically to Rav Avramitel and to lesser extent Rav Lichtenstein. And this is all secondhand. You'll be able to talk to many people who studied with both of these figures really firsthand. I studied in the yeshiva from starting the year 2013. Rav Avramitel passed away in 2010. And Rav Lichtenstein at the time, who would then pass away himself in 2015, was still in the yeshiva, and he certainly had a major role, even if just representing a certain set of ideals and values in the yeshiva when I was there, but we weren't learning directly from these figures. So a lot of what I know and the ideas that stick out to me from them are secondhand, kind of by way of their students who were my teachers when I was studying in yeshiva. Okay, so that's all by way of biography. A really important figure. His works deal with a number of important areas of philosophy, to a lesser extent history. He has books on reflecting on the Holocaust and his experience in the Holocaust as well. Amazing resources, very broadly, and happy to share more of them afterwards, time permitting. But that's all by way of biography. Let's talk about ideas. So one major idea, this is almost a meme in the yeshiva, or a trope, right? People joke about this. You could, kind of reference the story, and everyone knows exactly what you're talking about. It's one of the most well-known stories associated with the yeshiva, and that is the story of the crying baby. This is a story that Avramitel would tell very frequently. This is one version of the story that I found online. There was a story of the elder Admor, the Baal HaTanya, who was the founding Rebbe of Chabad Chassidus, who was sitting and learning in his room. But suddenly, he heard a baby crying in its crib. The Admor closed his Gemara, went to the room of the baby, and calmed him down. Afterwards, the Admor went to the adjacent room and found his grandson sitting entrenched in his learning. The Admor challenged his grandson. Why did you not get up to calm down the crying baby? The confused grandson raised his gaze and answered his grandfather. I was so entrenched in learning that I didn't hear the sound of crying at all. His grandfather pointed out to him, if a person is learning Torah and doesn't hear the crying of a Jewish baby, something is flawed in the learning. And for Avramitel, what the story represented, it was not just the story of a piety of a certain great figure, but it was really a mission statement for her to think about a yeshiva. Avramitel, again, founding Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Har Etzion, And for him, the idea of a yeshiva where learning Torah isn't something that isolates you from caring for other people, it's something that binds you to care for other people and obligates you to do so. And if your learning separates you from doing chesed, then it's some, then there's something missing or lacking in your learning. There's another now still living religious Zionist rabbi in Israel, Rabbi Yosef Tzvi Rimon, who I recently heard say something similar. He said he knows that he had a successful session of learning when he gets up and he wants to do chesed. And that if you succeeded in your learning, it will be an inspiration to help and to engage and not to be isolated and block yourself off from the world, which is a conceivable way to think about the value of Torah learning. And this value is reflected in the building of Yeshivat Har Etzion. It was founded in Kfar Etzion, basically in a military bunker and then or barracks. It was moved to Alon Shvut a few years later, where this Beit Midrash was built. And you'll notice on the sides a number of windows. And this is part of the lore of the yeshiva as well. When you first get there, you know, you hear about how the yeshiva was built with walls. It was built with walls, but with windows. And with the idea being that one doesn't cloister oneself off from the world when one is involved in high-level learning, when one is involved in yeshiva. You actually open yourself to the world, and you need to be able to see out into the world and have the world see in to what's happening in the Beit Midrash as well. And that's part of the real ethos of the yeshiva that I experienced. Okay, that is a couple of his major ideas. You know, there's what to say about his approach to understanding the Holocaust, his approach to the role that halacha plays in the Jewish state. There are a number of issues where he has made very significant contributions. But we're going to focus on one for today, one kind of glaring contemporary issue of really great philosophical import. And that's the question of the role of natural morality. Just as a resource for any future reading, and I'm happy to discuss other resources as well at the end, but this English volume called Jewish Values in a Changing World is a really essential volume for an introduction into Amital's approach and worldview and thinking. It's a collection of his sichot, his discourses in the yeshiva that were translated into English and Hebrew and anthologized into a really useful volume. And that's where a lot of our work today begins. So in thinking about natural morality, the role of morality, we have two main questions, and there'll be some side questions that kind of trickle out from those. Our first question is there even such a thing as natural morality? Right? That claim isn't necessarily self-evident, I think, especially in the kind of postmodern context in which we live. The idea that there's any sort of innate sense of goodness and truth, something that is immediately and objectively perceptible to everyone, is something that needs to be justified a little bit. You need to be able to explain why you think that morality and our own moral feelings have weight. And second of all, even if they have weight, what weight do they have relative to the Torah? What is the relationship between any moral impulse I have and the Torah? And that's partially, you know, the extreme manifestation of this problem is when you think about morality that seems to conflict with the Torah, when you have a Torah commandment that seems to be morally difficult and challenging. And we will touch on a couple of those examples, a couple of those ideas a little bit later. But even just thinking about what are the sources of authority that bind me? What are the things that obligate me to behave in a certain way? And if morality is one of those things, how does that thing compare to the obligation I have to follow the Torah? This is something to which Rav Amital gave a great deal of thought. So those are two main questions we'll try to answer within his worldview and thinking, and we'll present it more or less along the lines of the discourses that he gave about the subject. Part of what we'll see going forward are sources that he quoted that were important for his thinking. Part of it are summaries of his own presentation. Some of it is his own words. We'll see different aspects of that as we continue. So starting with our first question, is there such a thing as natural morality? Rav Amital said emphatically, yes, of course there is such a thing as natural morality. He pointed to one proof text, and there are a couple of others that we'll see shortly. But one major text is as follows. This is a Gemara in Masechet Eruvin. And the Gemara here tells us that, basically, imagine a world where the Torah had not been given. Hard thing to imagine. But would there be anything that, any responsibilities that we held, any imperatives that we'd be bound to follow? And the Gemara seems to say, yes, we would have moral imperatives. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yochanan says, Il malim lo Torah, if the Torah had not been given, we would have learned privacy or modesty from cats. The gazelle mina mala, and we would have learned that the wrongness of stealing from ants. The arayot miyona, and proper ways to engage in intimacy from the dove. Derech Eretz Mitarnagol, similarly from chickens as well, Shemefayis V'achakach Bola, first appeases its mate before actually mating. And the idea that Rabbi Yochanan is getting at is that there's a certain kind of moral order baked into creation, just like there is a physical or natural order. So we see at the beginning of Bereshit, God creates the world and he creates it in this orderly system, things happening in their proper day, everything in its proper place. And just like there's a physical order to the universe, at the same time, and bound up with that is the sense of moral order. That you look at all the physical things in the world, all the animals, all the creatures, and they reflect a certain kind of morality that is baked in, that is inherent in nature. And it's not something that, purely human construct that we impose upon our world, but it really is something that is in the fabric of creation itself. Chazal tell us, the sages tell us that God looked into the Torah and created the world. And if you look at the Torah is a book of morality, right? The Torah tells you how to live, what to do, what not to do, moral stories, stories that teach values. And the idea that you would look into that book and create a world is hard to understand until you see that there's a sense of shared order in that source. And the Torah reflects both a physical order, the order of the physical world and the laws of nature that we experience, as well as a sense of morality that permeates the world as well. And the sense that there's a real true right and wrong that can be perceived and that we can draw on and learn from. And if not from the Torah, then at least from other aspects of the natural world. And this is a particularly important idea because you study the stories of the book of Bereshit or some example will be shortly. And we see plenty of examples of people without the Torah being held to moral standards. So we think about the Mabul, the flood. These are people who are living in a world without the Torah had not been given, and they're being punished and the world is being wiped out for various corruptions in society, various moral failings. The city of Sodom as well was being held to a moral standard that they were responsible to live up to, even in the absence of the Torah. Probably a very extreme example of this is in these psukim here from Sefer Devarim, talking about the prohibition to allow an Ammoni or Moavi, an Ammonite or Moabite, to marry into the Jewish people. And the justification for the prohibition is al devar asher lo kidmu etchem balechem uvamayim, because they did not come out for you with bread and with water, baderech betzeitchem yitzrayim, in the time that we were leaving Egypt. Vasher sachar alech et Bilam ben Beor, and the fact that Bilam was hired, as we will read in a few weeks in Parshat Balak, mipitor aram naharayim lekalalecha. They hired a nation, Bilam, a sorcerer, to curse us. So the second reason I understand, they were our enemy. They were trying to curse us and eliminate us. So not marrying into them is pretty intuitive. But this first idea is very puzzling. Right? They're being punished. They're being excluded from the Jewish people because they didn't go out of their way to present us with food and drink while wandering through the desert. I think the idea that Amital was drawing out of these psukim is that that's a basic moral imperative. You see recently freed slaves traveling in the desert. They're hungry. They're thirsty. And you have food and water, and you don't bring it to them, that's a moral failing, and that means you can't be admitted into the Jewish people. You can't be allowed to marry into the Kahal Hashem, as these psukim describe. And again, there's a sense of natural morality being binding, even though there was no mitzvah to bring out food and wine to these traveling desert people. So for Rav Amital, that's clear evidence that there's a sense of morality that permeates the Torah, even independent a divine command. Okay, so that's all great in theory, right? We start at the beginning of creation, the beginning of history, and there is a sense of binding morality. But the question is, what, if anything, changed when the Torah was given? Does morality still bind us once we've gotten the Torah? We could argue morality is great. Morality was really important in understanding the narratives of the book of Bereshit, the narratives of our forefathers, the Avot and Imam. But that was our best intuitive grasp, our intuitive sense of what God wanted us to do. Then Hashem gave us the Torah. And now that we have the Torah, he told us what to do. So what relevance does morality have at that point? And you could argue, as Rav Amital summarizes this perspective here, maybe none. Maybe the natural morality lost its validity once the Torah was given. And now the Torah is the sort of superseding force in the world, that we had our obligations to the Torah are the only obligations that exist. And the logic of this point of view is what Amital describes, that's starting in the fourth line here. According to this point of view, which zealously tries to defend the honor of the Torah, there is no connection between God, creator of man, and God, giver of the Torah. Now, the second part of the sentence is the implicit criticism. But start from the beginning, it defends the honor of Torah to say that Torah is the highest level of obligation that we have. If we're bound to the Torah more than we're bound to anything else, perhaps exclusively bound to the Torah, well, that's just the Torah at a pinnacle for us. That's the highest possible order, the highest possible sense of obligation that we can have. But the problem that he alludes to already is that it's hard to imagine or hard to understand that the God who created the world, who gave us an inherent moral sense that we're meant to actualize and that we were meant to actualize for thousands of years before the Torah was given, all of a sudden becomes irrelevant. All of a sudden, those kinds of imperatives became meaningless to us, and only the imperatives of the Torah mattered. He summarizes, or he provides some support from this perspective of the Rambam. We'll skip in the interest of time, but I'm happy to share these resources with anyone who wants after this as well. Rav Amital's perspective is a little bit different. Even after the Torah was given, he says, natural morality retains its special role of guiding man in all his paths. And he quotes a line from Rav Kook, one of his major intellectual influences. Morality in its natural state, with all its profound splendor and might, must be fixed in the soul, so that it may serve as a substratum for the great effects emanating from the strength of Torah. And you can underline this if you like. Every element of Torah must be preceded by Derech Eretz. Every element of Torah needs natural morality, natural ethics to support it and supplant it. Not supplant it, I'm sorry, to support it and combine with it. If it is something agreeable to natural reason and uprightness, it must pass in a straight path with the inclination of the heart and the consent of the pure will implanted in man, like theft, illicit sexual relations, and modesty, which are learned from the ant, the dove, and the cat, that Gemara we saw much earlier. Rav Kook writes in a sort of poetic style, but for Rav Amital, the simple idea is very clear, which is that even in a world with the Torah, morality isn't irrelevant. Morality is hand in hand with our responsibility to the Torah. It's not one or the other. It's not that one trumps the other necessarily. It's that the two combine and they work together. Okay, so are we obligated to be moral? He writes sources from the Rambam as well to support this. And this is a really nice source because the Rambam in this source basically argues not only are we obligated to do these things, but that the same sense of reward and punishment that we have for following the Torah also applies to morality. An obedient individual receives compensation for all the pious and righteous actions he has accomplished, even if he was not ordered by a prophet to do them, and that he is punished for all evil acts committed by him, even if he was not forbidden by a prophet to do them. In other words, there are multiple kinds of binding imperatives that we could experience. We could have binding imperatives that bind our actions that come from the Torah, and we get rewarded and punished for those. And just the same, we have moral imperatives. And those moral imperatives that we know intuitively that are baked within our consciousness and our nature by the very fabric of creation themselves, those are equally binding and you're equally rewarded and punished for them as well. So for Amital already, we've seen, you know, number one, the idea that natural morality is baked into our existence, baked into our essence, and that we're meant to follow it, and it was always inherently expected, and that expectation lasted even when the Torah was given. And the Torah doesn't supersede or override moral imperatives, but it complements them and it works with them. Perhaps it builds on top of them. We'll give this Gemara in interest of time as well. This is a Gemara in Masechet Sota that discusses how a lot of moral behavior is something that we that is reflective not only of an internal moral sense, but an internal divine sense. This Gemara here talks about the idea of following in the ways of God. And says, just like God does all of these moral things, he cares for the sick, he comforts mourners, he buries the dead, so too we are bound to do so as well. A really fascinating source to look at when you get the chance. Now, we can ask the question, and this is, I think, an important philosophical question. The summary here by Professor Alan Brill, he's a professor of Jewish philosophy, is really, really helpful. Just if we have moral imperatives, and if God wants us to follow those moral imperatives, so why aren't they in the Torah? Right? Why doesn't the Torah tell us, by the way, you should comfort mourners. By the way, you should bury the dead. Bury the dead is not necessarily a great example. There is a mitzvah there. Let's say visiting the sick. These are rabbinic commandments, rabbinic manifestations of values, but they could be commanded in the Torah. So it provides different perspectives or ideas on this. And the sense you get is that morality is meant to represent a different part of a more holistic religious personality. Meaning, we're not meant to only be rule-following automatons who follow the laws of the Torah as exactly legislated. But part of developing a moral personality or a religious personality is being guided by an independent moral sense. He formulates this end, starting in the second paragraph, in several ways. First, we must emulate the actions of the patriarchs through being individually inspired by their exemplary, true moral behavior. Second, we should go beyond their actions and personally act out of natural morality based on internal motivation, as did the patriarch. Third, we need to understand that to be voluntarily ethical is greater than being commanded to be ethical. Therefore, in contrast to the halachic hierarchy, where those who are commanded receive greater reward than those who are not commanded, the ethical realm provides rewards for volunteerism, and that volunteering to be ethical is actually a higher level than being commanded to be ethical. That there's part of being a personality that is motivated by a true sense of good and bad, a true sense of right and wrong, that we're meant to cultivate within ourselves. Just to pick one example I didn't put on the slides, that I think really reflects this. There's a halachic discussion about why the mitzvah of a tzedakah, or the mitzvah of, let's say, mishloach manot, doesn't have a bracha. So we could think about this from a lot of different technical angles. Is there an action that you're doing that can obligate a person in a bracha? Biblical mitzvah versus rabbinic mitzvah, different ways of thinking about this. But the Sridei Eish, or Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, has a responsum where he discusses this question, and he says, who do you think is really a better person? A person who says, I'm going to give you this dollar because I was commanded by God to do so, and by giving this to you, I'm receiving great amounts of religious reward for fulfilling a mitzvah of the Torah? Or a person who sees someone poor and gives them money because they need it, and is motivated by that inherent moral sense? Obviously the latter. So reciting a bracha on this mitzvah, reciting a bracha on the idea of giving tzedakah or shloach manot or these other mitzvahs that are fundamentally moral, would undercut the value of the mitzvah itself, would undercut the sense that we're developing a religious personality that is motivated to care for others and to be good, and replacing it with one that is motivated by strict kind of legalism. So I think in reflecting this idea that there are really two complementary tracks of how we're meant to live. We're meant to live in accordance with the laws of the Torah, and we're meant to live with the ethical imperatives, but those are things that we have to opt into, that we have to feel inspired by and generate inspiration to continue to pursue. And these two pieces go together for Rav Amital. They're not in contradiction. We'll have to leave tensions and conflict between halacha and morality for a little bit later, but just to get to this final dilemma, which is also a classic trope or a classic piece of the lore in the yeshiva, in Yeshivat Har Tzion. There are two desert island dilemmas. There's one that's a little bit more famous. So we mentioned the two founding Rashi Yeshiva of Yeshivat Har Tzion, Amital and Rav Lechinstein. And they disagreed about the following situation. You wake up and you're on a desert island. You were on a plane. The plane crashed. You're the only survivor on the island. And you're getting hungry. You need to eat. You're not being rescued anytime soon. You need to sustain yourself. And on the island, there are two sources of food. The first source of food is pigs. They're animals that are unambiguously treif, unambiguously non-kosher. There are explicit verses in the Torah that tell you not to eat them. And the other food source is human flesh. So what do you do? What should you eat? So in terms of the halachic hierarchy here, there's no ambiguity. There's an explicit verse in the Torah that prohibits eating pigs, and there's no explicit verse in the Torah that prohibits eating people. It could be that it's a rabbinic prohibition. It could be that it's a lower level biblical prohibition that's inferred from other verses, but isn't as explicit and has a lower level of authority. But the halakha calculus is very clear that eating pigs seems to be a higher level prohibition than eating people. Does that mean that's what you're meant to do? So Rav Lichtenstein thought, yes, halakha is our finding religious value, and we're not in a position to choose to put other values ahead of it. There are different versions of the story, by the way. In some versions of the story, Rav Lichtenstein said he would eat the person. In other versions of the story, he said he would eat the pig, but then do tshuva for it. Meaning, he would think it was the, you know, halachically wrong, suboptimal thing to do, but his own moral sense would prevent him from ever being able to actually do it. So there are different versions of the story, which I think are interesting. But Rav Amital's presentation, because of his idea of natural morality, becomes much more stark. He says, what is the law in a case where a person is faced with a choice between a food forbidden by the Torah and human flesh? skipping the halachic summary here. I provided that summary earlier as well. But is it really true that the sick person should partake of human flesh and not from foods prescribed by Torah law, like untithed produce or the flesh of an improperly slaughtered animal? He says that can't be the case. You obviously are meant to eat the pig and not eat the person. And he provides support from, we mentioned him earlier, Rav Moshe Shmuel Glasner. He wrote a commentary called Dor Revi'i, which is a commentary on Tractate Chulin, and the grandfather of his teacher, Rav Chaim Yehuda Halevi. And this is what he writes about the same exact case. He says, but tell me now, a dangerously ill patient having to choose between meat from an improperly slaughtered or defective animal and human flesh, what should he eat? Do we say that he should eat the human flesh, which is not prohibited by a Torah prohibition, even though it is forbidden by the moral code accepted by civilized men, so that anyone eating or feeding another person human flesh is cast out from the community of men, rather than eat meat which the Torah forbids with a negative commandment? Would it enter your mind that we, the chosen people, a wise and understanding people, should violate this moral code in order to save ourselves from violating a Torah prohibition? And the answer, by implication, obviously is not. We're obviously not meant to do so. And there's a certain sense in which the Dor Revi'i and Rav Amital, it's unclear exactly how deeply he accepts this extreme formulation, but the Dor Revi'i thinks there are some things that cut so firmly against our moral sense that they're as prohibited as something explicitly written in the Torah. Why not write them in the Torah? Because we don't need them to be written in the Torah to know that they're wrong. I don't need a pasuk in the Torah to tell me that this is a horrifying thing to do. I need my own moral sense, which is a prerequisite for being able to receive the Torah and understand and properly interpret the Torah. So with that healthy moral sense, I know that cannibalism is wrong. I know even that eating people who are already, without the aspect of killing them, just eating human flesh is wrong. And I would obviously prefer to eat the pork instead of the person. Rav Amital goes on to offer some partial halakhic justifications, but that's not what's motivating his presentation. What motivates Rav Amital's presentation is his deep conviction that our internal sense of morality, our own sense of right and wrong, transcends and supplements the work of the Torah. That the Torah's project and the Torah's goals have to go together with our own moral sense. And if the Torah seems to be presenting a situation where it's so deeply opposed to our moral intuitions here, then we're in a tricky place because the morality and the Torah are meant to go together well. If we want to stick around for a few extra minutes, we could talk about the tensions, but just seeing that the idea that a moral precept is not only something that's real, as we started with, a binding concept, and not only is binding after the Torah is given, but is authoritative like the Torah is authoritative. And that a law that's written in the Torah, and a law that we know so deeply and inherently to be true, must be compatible. It must be possible to keep those both in mind. And that, I think, is a major idea for Rav Amital understanding this this idea, application of natural morality. So just to review what we've seen, and happy to questions, happy to discuss some other issues that come up tangentially. These we talked about Rav Amital's biography, his move from his upbringing in Europe through the Holocaust to Israel, where he had opportunities to study, to teach, and to found a very influential yeshiva, Yeshivat Har Etzion. We talked about some of his major ideas and contributions in terms of the role of Hezder Yeshivot, to pick one prominent example, but some of the other ideas as well, about land for peace and other values. And then we started talking about his idea of natural morality, how Rav Amital develops both the idea that natural morality exists, the idea that it's binding, the idea that it's binding after the Torah is given, and the idea that it's binding like the Torah is binding, that we're meant to actualize these two aspects of ourselves, this halachic aspect, one that follows the Torah, that follows the divine will, that applies and lives according to the Torah, and the one that lives according to the divine will as manifest in our own nature, the one that recognizes moral truth and considers themselves bound by them. And these ideas are essential for Rav Amital and really permeated the yeshiva where I had the pleasure to study. So that sort of wraps up the presentation. I'll stop the share, so happy to discuss any questions, any follow-ups. Otherwise, it was great to get informed with everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming. Stop the recording.